everybody. Good to have you with us here on this lovely spring day here on the Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. It is a beautiful spring day, but there is something amiss in Baltimore City with the violence plaguing our town, with the numbers of murders and shootings and robberies way up beyond what they were last year. According to the articles in the Baltimore Sun, the mayor's office of criminal justice is in disarray with no real leadership, people resigning, nobody replaced, losing money, no money coming in, programs being cut. We'll talk about some new ones we just heard about this morning. So the question is, what do we do? Clearly, there has to be a police presence, but it's more than just about a police presence. It has to do with how we build public safety, both in the short term to make the community safe again, and in the long term, about what we do to end what we face. And as we were talking the other day about criminal justice here on the program, among other things, in a broader discussion, where you have people like Jeff Sessions saying crime is up around the country, which is not true, but it is up in the poorest, most dispossessed communities in the United States, Baltimore being one of them. A large portion of Baltimore being one of them. So what do we do? So please join us here with your thoughts and ideas. 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talkatsteinershow.org by email. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. But please do join us. We want to hear your thoughts. So in the studio once again, Doug Ward, who spent, I always forget the exact number, 30 years, is it?
27. Close 27, enough.
Close. 27 years in the Maryland State
Seems
Police.
Seems like a lifetime.
Well, now you're in a second lifetime. So it's 27 years in the Maryland State Police and one of our leading experts on law enforcement. Doug is now the director of the Johns Hopkins University's Division of Public Safety Leadership that trained police officers from across the country. Nicole Hansen's in the house. She is the executive director of Out for Justice and it's a program that works with people, formerly incarcerated people, she being among them. And the house, good to have you back in the house, Nicole. And Clayton Guyton joins us, who is a former correctional officer and founder and executive director of the Rose Street Community Center that works on ending violence in his community in a very successful way, as well as building community in the East Side neighborhood of Rose and Ashland. And Clayton, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
And you all can join us again. Please do. 410-319-8888. We want to hear your ideas and thoughts. 410-319-8888. So where do we begin? I mean, we talk about this a lot in the program, obviously. We've been doing it for years, and recently we're doing it more and more because of what we see that's happening around the city. But why do we think, first of all, from the top, there seems to be such disarray inside the administration? I know it's a brand-new administration. Mayor Pugh just walked into office, mm-hmm. but people have been resigning right and left. And nothing's been put in place in terms of people taking over certain positions. Maybe people expect too much out of things too quickly. I don't know. But that's a very critical sector in the mayor's office. Is the mayor's office coordinating his office for criminal justice. Doug, I mean, what do you think? I know your job is not to talk about politics of it, but what do you think is happening here?
Well, I think there is some turmoil with any new administration and trying to get the right people in the right places. This may be a bit more than that. I don't know. I don't know the details, but all I have to do is look to Washington, D.C. to find out the turmoil in a new administration and how dysfunctional that can be. But, I mean, I'm hoping they get this together quickly. It is a very important office, and we depend on the mayor's office for leadership in a lot of areas, and so I'm hopeful they'll get it together.
I mean, Clayton, You deal with this every day and deal with these kind of sectors every day. What are your thoughts on why this is happening?
I think it's an erosion of trust between city government, law enforcement, and the community. You don't know exactly where the trust erosion began. Maybe it began years and years and years ago, but now it's to a boiling point of where the community doesn't trust the police, most definitely. Even with the DOJ report, we still have a large amount of distrust that's occurring between our community and the police department because they seem not to care that this report has been put in place. It's like, okay, when we're around you in the community, African-American community, we wear one face, one mask, but when we get before others, such as politicians or people that's in leadership, then we're going to act like this DOJ report really means something. And it's as though they have gotten the message from Washington that the DOJ report doesn't mean much. So it's erosion of trust.
Nicole Hansen.
Why the mayor's office is in such disarray? I think, like the gentleman said before, with any new administration, it's, you know, you're kind of weaning out those folks who don't want to be there anymore. You're trying to build new relationships with individuals. I don't know. It's just really hard because I'm not there. I'm not in the mayor's office. I'm not so much connected to individuals who work in that office. I'm just hopeful that the mayor, I'm just hopeful that she will be able to figure out ways to connect with community folks who are willing to do that work over there in the mayor's office and be open to individuals who want to do that work as opposed to, you know, kind of keeping, you know, those same infrastructures that exist or keeping those same people in place who have been there for like a number of years and maybe it's time, you know, to go and retire and move on. So I'm hopeful that she has connections to individuals. I'm hopeful that she knows enough folks that she can trust that could, you know, help guide her to build a better mayor's office.
And Chase, you're the first caller up. I'm going to come to your call after this next question, so stay with us at 410-319-8888. We really want to hear your ideas and thoughts, because the question becomes, oh, and I've asked this question, I guess, as I say sometimes, ad nauseum for a long time. But what is a mayor to do? What is a city to do? You now have the controversy over the city police. It was part of the editorial page in this morning's Sun that do not want to release the report on the officers in the Freddie Gray case after 2 years, saying it's a personnel matter. Mm-hmm. You have the head of DOJ, clearly, which is going to be backing away from all this stuff in Washington and kind of putting their arms around the police, and we have to protect our police,
right.
And attacking Black Lives Matter, the movement. But beyond that, so we do have a crisis in this city. I mean,
absolutely.
And so the question is, we know that I think that the underlying social and economic and lack of racial equity issues that are causing this rise in violence. But what do you do immediately, and what do you do long term? I mean, you can't just let this keep cycling out of control, which is what it feels like it's doing to most people. You teach police officers across country. This is not just a police issue, but the police are at the heart of a lot of it.
So what we try and foster is the fact that police are in a unique position and in contact with both the governmental structures and the community structures. And if they do their work in the best way, they're natural leaders in their community and within especially other governmental organizations. So people will look to the police as, you know, help us determine what do we do next, right? So the arguments that we continue to have for years and years and years about what to do next creates a situation where we don't know what to do because we don't have a plan. You know, and I've said this for years, and I guess I'll keep saying it till nobody listens to me, but we need – this is going to take 20 years to get out of. It's not something you can flip a switch and it's going to fix itself tomorrow. There's no one approach. There's probably 20 or 30 different approaches from different disciplines that have to be coordinated and prioritized, and I think it gets to your question. What do you do first? First thing you do, you build trust. There's got to be trust between the police and the community. People have to build trust over time. It's what you say and what you do over time that builds trust. You have to say what you're going to do and do what you said you were going to do, and people have to see that many times to say, okay, you know what, I think you will. How can the police protect citizens? How do you get witnesses to come forward when they have to live in a community where, unfortunately, the police can't protect them? I mean, let's face facts here. Police have to protect people. People have to rise above and come forward and work with the police to do that. That's a tricky situation. I think you need more police out there on the street, whether you reassign them out there, whether you hire more, however you do it. I don't think we have enough police out there on the street in the communities building relationships. And I think the police department knows all this. They're working on it. I mean, I know people are working very hard trying to do the right thing. But it takes more than the police.
Clayton?
Well, The part about needing more police on the street, I have to disagree with that point. You can have 1,000 police on the street, and if they're not properly trained, what you get, you get more of the same situation. It just becomes a exasperated problem. What we need to do is downsize the amount of police that's in the community and form relationships with the community. Have police that are qualified in terms of understanding the trust value, and let them develop relationships with the community and keep the same police in a community for more than 4 years. Have police sign up for long-term positions in the community. In other words, be there from the time you start until the time you retire. Now, I know this police officer. Why? Because when I was 10 years old, I knew him. At 15 years, I know him. 20. So the answer is not more police.
Well, I mean, I think we are agreeing. Maybe I didn't say it very well.
Okay.
I think in the situation we're in, I do think, at least for the short term, we need more police out there, and I agree with you, they need to be the right police. Okay. So I can tell you right now for sure, because I'm the people in the training units in the Baltimore Police Department, mm-hmm. they get what we're talking about, and they're trying to hire people in that spirit of mm-hmm. service, and they're trying to and they're training them differently in a way to connect them more to the community. And that's not the total answer. It'd be nice to hire more people to live in the city as police officers. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that ought to be really, you know, I know it's hard to do, but it needs to be done. People, you know, police, if they live in the communities, mm-hmm. they're part of it. They're coaching basketball and mm-hmm. baseball. You know, they're going to the churches. And so they're part of the fabric of the community. I see Absolutely. That working in rural areas so well.
Yes, it does.
Right? And everybody knows who the trooper is.
Right.
Because the car's sitting in the driveway, and they're at coaching the game.
You're talking about in Maryland?
Yes.
In the state of Maryland, you're talking about people in the rural areas?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it works really well. You know, you don't need a whole lot of them, but the community rallies around them. They're part of the fabric of the community. And you see it in a lot of other jurisdictions, not just rural areas, but in places where the police live and work. When you come into the city and it's a place to come in and have fun and then go back home, that's a different attitude in some cases. Mm. Not all. You know, but I say, you know, it's in the best case, you have police officers who live in the jurisdiction where they work.
So let me open the phones here. We have a couple online, and then we'll come right back to the panel and let you respond to our listeners. 410-319-8888. We have Walker and Chase in that order. We'll come to your calls. And Walker, this is Walker Gladden. I think, Walker, you're on the air. Welcome.
All right.
Welcome. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. It's been a long time since I've heard your voice. Good to have you.
It's a beautiful a day to be had.
Yes, sir.
I just want to just comment on a couple of things real briefly. Hey, Pop, how you doing?
I'm doing all right, son.
Yes, sir. I think one of the most important things right now is which is a part of the fabric of the community, is darkness. Hmm. And I think love, care, consideration is one of the keys to be implemented in the heart of the community, because if darkness is there and it become a part of the fabric of the community, and as a solutionist, I think that for those of us from an equality and from a conjunction community perspective, light needed to be added into that process. Mm-hmm. So I think that in retrospect, dealing with light, I think that solutions from all of our perspectives, from a community perspective, from a law enforcement perspective, from a church perspective, from a mosque perspective, mm-hmm. holistically speaking, once the light is implemented, I'll give you an example. I watch the ID channel. What I learned about the ID channel is I see a value that those particular officers, I'm not speaking about all officers in particular, I'm just speaking about the heart of our community in particular. Now, one thing I noticed about the ID channel and the officers that go after homicide cases is they have a different value of what they're doing and what they're going after. So I said, man, wow, they have a consideration, they have a care. And I said that all officers does not carry that. But what I'm saying in our community, because of the fabric of darkness that exists there, and there's not a lot of light that's being placed there, that means that the relationship is already broken. So I'm looking at the quality of law enforcement on the ID channel versus the law enforcement in Baltimore City. and the value that they put in the heart and the passion that they put about cold cases and crime, you know, things of that nature. I don't know what our cold case stats are at this point, but do we have officers out there that's genuine and care and considerate from a community perspective and a holistic perspective to put light back in the community to heal some of this darkness that's in place? So, yeah, we together, collectively, can bring that process back into place. It's not a 20-year process. It's a light process that needs to be placed in a dark place.
Walker, good to hear you. Glad you're back.
Yeah. Thank you, Walker.
Comments before we hit our next caller?
Well, I think, you know, I think the caller's right with the comments. The question is, how do you get to that, right? And about the the homicide investigators in the police department, I think it's really important to keep in context that although there are certainly some problem areas in the police department and problem people in the police department is aware of that. They're working on trying to fix that. There are an overwhelming number of very competent, hardworking, well-intended police officers in there who want to do the right thing. They need the right leadership to help them do that, and they're also overwhelmed. I mean, when you're in a situation like this and you're looked at as the police and you're supposed to fix this homicide problem, police are not good at fixing homicide problems. They're after the fact. They come there when the body's on the ground. That's too late. My 20-year comment is you got to fix this. It's going to take time. It's got to start with prenatal care, early childhood education, jobs. What do you do with people who are incarcerated and come out and can't get a job? Where are the jobs? Where's the reasonable housing? You know, where are the support systems that people need to get out of poverty? You know, this is an economic issue as much as is anything else. Where's hope? In hopelessness, in despair, that's where gangs thrive. What about the demand for the drugs? Who's buying all these drugs? It's not the people in the inner city. It's people out there in rural areas with money buying these drugs. What are we doing about that? Mm-hmm. We have a huge drug epidemic in this country. It's causing this. You know, so that's what I mean. It gets almost right. Overwhelming really quickly. But if everybody does their part on every front, it's the best hope we have, and it's going to take a long time.
And I think also the police department willing to fix things internally, right, and the public seeing that they are willing to identify where they went wrong and not just say, oh, we're going to fix things, but do it through policy, you know, through legislation. I mean, the community is, you know, pretty much, I know with a lot of community advocates that I know, we are really concerned about the Public Information Act, right? And giving community members the opportunity to see somewhere what these officers are doing. And, you know, I think if officers knew that their wrongdoings would be exposed, right, and people could literally see and track their reports and what they're doing, I think they would begin to think twice about their actions. So, yes, the police department will easily say, we want to fix things, we want to work with community, but what are they doing, legislatively that really, you know, show that they're willing to change those policies that, you know, kind of create these barriers?
But go ahead.
Well, even the city politicians, too, have a part to play. Short-term solution. Everybody that was locked up because of those officers is now in the feds.
Tell it.
We wrote a letter asking the city council, the mayor, and others that's involved, pass a resolution that says, look, we encourage the employers, right, of the ones that is incarcerated, that lost their jobs due to this false evidence, encourage them to hire them back. We wrote that letter like 3 months ago. We have yet to get a response. I'm going to tell you the one response that we got, our legal department is looking into it. You cannot pass a resolution that encourages employers to hire back those that was a victim of a false evidence. So where is the actual action that's going on here? That will be one step in the healing process.
Yeah, and I would take it like a step further.
Go ahead.
Like, city resolution, but I would take it a step further and, you know, going to the state, those individuals. You know, that's what I mean by actually internally identifying that, that something was done wrong. And then not only just talking about that you're willing to change it, but showing it.
Yes.
So collectively going to the state, right, and saying, hey, we've identified that we have certain officers who have made some poor choices. And in the result of that, there are thousands of individuals who now have a criminal record. And because of that criminal record, these folks can't find jobs. They can't find housing. And it's becoming a revolving cycle, right? And so, you know, what I would say is a way, like what I mean is taking it a step further, you know, supporting legislation that immediately expunges the records of those individuals who were, you know, unjustly, you know, convicted. You know, even with the DOJ report, I think I talked to Chief Martin. I hope I'm saying her name right. You know, the young lady that's out in the community is talking about the DOJ report and how they could, you know, bridge the gap with community. And I said, like, there needs to be an effort right now, right, that figures out a way. The police department needs to go to the state and say, listen, we want to support legislation that states that we want these individuals' records immediately expunged.
Can I ask you a question, sis?
Sure.
Where's my apology? Nobody has apologized to me. My city council person hasn't apologized to me. The police chief hasn't apologized to me. The city council president hasn't apologized to me. The mayor hasn't apologized to me. The state attorney hasn't apologized to me. Where is my apology? It begins there, I think.
I mean, I think at this point, the apology is like...
That's cool. Okay. I think that this, what we're talking about here is the widening disconnect between... especially members of not just black community, but especially members of black community who live in neighborhoods that are deeply affected by the violence and war going on, and the police, between the aftermath of Freddie Gray, these officers being indicted, there's a gulf that's widening. And I think part of it is you see also is that police are retreating from their work at the same time.
No, sir.
No, they are, because the arrests are down. Everything is down. They're not engaging the way they did because their engagement has led to some of the problems we have. And there's no way we're not coming up with ways to make it work.
Question, Omar.
Yeah.
Are they retreating in their harassment? No, they're not.
Okay.
We just had a young man that was beat up yesterday by the police. They may be retreating in one way.
Right.
But then there's other ways where their anger is coming forward.
So we're going to turn this over to our listeners here right after the break. So Chase and everyone else, we're going to come right to your calls. But do you want to take us to break with a thought after what you just heard?
It just Doug? Paints a picture that if that's true, that the police are moving away and the citizenry moving the other direction, that's going to compound this problem. And my biggest worry is, as I told former Commissioner Batts when he first got here and was telling me how everything was great, I said, you haven't been here for a summer in Baltimore, and we're about to have another one.
So we're about to take a short break and come right back. When we do, Chase, we're coming right to your call. And Ray and Leo, all your calls are going to get in at 410-319-8888. See if you can help us figure out how to bridge the gap and make public safety work. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back here to the Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we are here with Nicole Hansen, who is the Executive Director of Out for Justice, with Doug Ward, who is Director of the Johns Hopkins University Division of Public Safety Leadership, and Clayton Guyton, Executive Director of the Rose Street Community Center. And you all at 410-319-8888. What I said during break was, it feels like we have these same circular conversations all the time these days on where we go. And the question becomes, do we want a larger police department, a smaller police department, a more effective presence in the street? What does that mean? Not just the street, but there's a difference between saying a more effective presence in the street and a more effective presence in community, which are two different concepts.
Yes, sir.
And how do we get, how does that happen? And then what happens when you start not investing the money in things like safe streets, other programs that actually might work to ameliorate the violence, investing in programs like Clayton Guyton's, where they do ameliorate the violence in their neighborhood, And then the larger issue is about what causes the systemic issues we have, which means a great deal more investment in thinking about how we invest our city's money. Your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Chase, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, Mark, you got me about to explode. I've been waiting for so long to just...
I'm sorry?
I understand. I understand. But you know what? First of all, in case anyone doesn't know, I want to qualify myself to say I'm a black man. I grew up in Baltimore City. I was a police cadet in the 70s, and at that time they had officer-friendly program. I think that's something that really needs to be brought back, have it in the schools, and have a time maybe once a month or whatever where the children can talk to these officers. And these officers have to be trained very well to be able to relate to children, and that's where you can bring some trust. And and I don't want the young lady to be offended from what I'm about to say, but, you know, we need people on your panel who are not bitter. I mean, she's representing justice, and justice is great. But the focus, and she has to realize that there are young black men and children that are going the wrong way. Today, I'm a bus driver. I've been driving a bus operator. I've been with MTA for 29 years. And I see the little children, their attitudes, and how they interact. You know, when you see children interact amongst one another, that is an example of what direction they may travel if they don't get righted. And this should not really be the focus about so much justice. This conversation should be more, my point is, we should be focusing on trying to correct the mentality of the young black youth. And if someone's, two wrongs don't make a right. If an officer arrested someone, that doesn't mean that his record should be wiped clean. I don't hear her addressing. This is an epidemic with these young black children and the mentality. I see it from the children as their children on the bus, in the middle, and into high school. And I challenge this woman to ride with me in the inner city, and I'm not saying all youth are like this, but it's a disproportionate that the children are headed down the wrong way, and two wrongs never make a right.
Chase, I appreciate the call. And so let's talk a bit about what he said here. And I think that sometimes it's too easy to dismiss things that as Chase said, but there is reality what Chase said as well, and how you put your hands around that. And I don't think he was demonizing the children so much as he's saying that some of our children have lost their way for lots of complex reasons, and how you deal with that. And that's his perspective from his job as an MTA driver, what he sees. So what do we think?
If I can respond. So thank you, Chase. I really appreciate, you know, your observation of my comment. And I was speaking based on a question that was asked of me, and I answered the question about the officers who are doing unjust things. And so I responded with the department figuring out a way to show these individuals who were wrongfully convicted that they truly want to change the department through policy reform. And that was my response. Now, I work in Baltimore City Public Schools. I have two children, 13 and 5. I do drive the bus. My car just broke down like 2 weeks ago, and I had to drive the MTA. I have family and friends who ride the MTA, and family and friends who are bus drivers. And so while I do understand that we do have children who, you know, are traumatized in many ways based on their upbringing or whatever, I think it's the community's responsibility. If you have parents that have not figured out ways to discipline their children, then we as community folks have to figure out ways to step in and support the youth, right? So then I ask, you know, what's the response when you see, you know, children acting out? You know, are you saying, hey, you know, that doesn't sound good coming from, you know, a beautiful young lady like yourself? Or are community folks just standing by listening? to it, and then, you know, talking about it in the comfort of their own homes. I know anybody that knows me will tell you that I'm nosy in that way. If I see children acting inappropriately, I will pull my car over and I will get out and I will talk with them. And so, like, you know, I'm not dismissing the fact that, yes, our children can be disrespectful, but, you know, on the other hand, we, you know, if those children don't see police officers respecting them, because we're going back to the conversation about police, if they don't see police officers respecting their older siblings, then they're not, you know, going to have much respect for police officers either. When I think about, you know, we're talking about so police.
Any quick thought on that, Clayton, before we move ahead?
I appreciate his call in. I think part of the problem, and it's not it's coming from different angles. We're identifying different ways to look at the problem that we have in our community. And I think he identified a very important problem, the bus driver. How does the bus driver factor into the solution? Mm-hmm. So he is able to see something that we can't see. So how do we partnership with him and other bus drivers like him to sit down at the table and talk about how can we address the problems when the students, the young people, get on the bus?
Right.
Bobby Marvin Holmes has tweeted in, if the children are wayward, it's because adults are wayward.
Right.
So look at our children as a problem in itself.
Right.
Exactly.
So let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888, and let's go to Ray. You're on the air. Welcome.
Mark. Good morning. Real quick, three quick points.
All right.
That will correlate these subjects. 25 years ago, I started a foundation that's called Fatherhood 6570. 72% of our children go 6,570 days without a father. That's root. That's root to what the bus driver talked about, to what your two guests just talked about. You can ask Earl Alameen this. No one nationally speaks about fatherhood more than I do Black fatherhood, but it's a conversation that's muted because we think we can fix our community from the outside in versus the inside out. It's not a blame the children or blame the father. When you've incarcerated an epidemic number of Black men, when you manufacture criminals through your prison and industrial complex, mm-hmm. of course you're going to have a community that looks like Lord of the Flies.
Hmm.
Now, the policemen are dealing with, and I'm not taking up the policemen before the your guest gets happy, the policemen are dealing with sociological, macroeconomic problems that they have nothing to do with. The fact of the matter is, at the same time, our policemen could learn a great deal from Japan, which had six handgun deaths in 2014, Britain, whose police officers fired their guns seven times in 2016, Germany, and I've told you this before, Mark,
yeah.
85 bullets they used in the entire year of 2011, resulting in six deaths of their citizens. 46 of those shots were warning shots. I could name 35 other countries that do not kill their citizens. Certainly, a large part of this is race in our country. The only other country that correlates with America killing Black people is, of course, South Africa, which has a similar history than America. But you cannot expect the police to deal with the lead problem in our city, the mental illness problem in our city. No other country kills mentally ill people except America. So are our police culpable? Of course they are. But are they causing the issues that they have to confront? No. So us blaming the police or us blaming our children and our parents is too simplistic. We have people in power, Senate and Congress, that have draconian institutes that have destroyed the safety nets of our children and families that continue to. And until we hold them accountable, I don't see anything changing. Indeed, I see it getting progressively worse.
Okay, Ray, appreciate the call. Let me get back to the panel. Let me get back to some of the other callers. And so Ray has said a lot.
Yeah, yes, and I think one of the things I take away from Ray's comments are we should be guided by science as much as possible. And there's an assault on science occurring at the federal level that worries me to no end. For many years now, we in policing have tried to use the products from research to ground us in what has the best chance of working the best in a certain situation. And these research studies from around the world are valuable. And we need to be guided by that, because we just can't keep changing what approaches to what we do based on a whim or what feels good or what's politically expedient every 4 years. That's why I say we have to have a 20-year plan based in science. And, of course, science is not perfect, but it's the best answer we have as a human species. And we've got to have something that spans across these 4-year political cycles and is resistant to, you know, like we talked about incarceration. I mean, the science is clear on that. We are stigmatizing a large section of our population that for the rest of their lives aren't going to be able to get a job. For what? For some minor crimes in some cases? Now, I don't think anybody wants to argue that serious violent criminals shouldn't be arrested and put in jail. I mean, that's an easy one. The tough ones come when you get into status crimes, you get into mental illness and homelessness, you get into, you know, minor drug usage or a lot of drug usage and addiction. It shouldn't be a crime that stigmatizes someone the rest of their life. I mean, it should be a medical situation. It's a public health issue. But we as citizens apparently don't really care that much about it because we don't do anything about it. So it's our own fault. We got to elect people who want to do the right thing, hold them accountable. We've got to get involved in politics. We've got to vote. We've got to get involved in our schools and to bring the youth up. I mean, yes, all of this. That's what I'm saying. It's, you know, a lot of factors here.
It is. And very few people look at it holistically. They just narrow in on one little piece.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. Thank you, Mark. I agree with you about the science. But I also think we need to add a moral piece to it, too.
How do you do that? What does that mean?
What do I mean?
Yeah.
Well, you take the best of principles that will enhance all of us as people in the community. Somewhere along the way, you got to meet with your religious institutions, and not only that, non-denominations, anybody, and you look at principles that we all should live by. Now, let's take one thing that may or may not be happening in Baltimore that we need to seriously take, the de-escalation. Police is, I don't know whether y'all teach this at Hopkins. If you're not teaching it now, you should be teaching it. The police do not involve themselves in de-escalation techniques. They always put you in a position where you want to say something negative to them. You want to curse them out because at first they come at you in a certain way. Now, let me give you a brief example.
Go ahead.
We had a homicide in our community not too long ago, you know, and the whole community was traumatized by this. One police officer said to one of the family members, "Oh, you should be all right with this." And the family would say, "What you mean?" Say, "Well, now she can get some rest." Yeah, that's what we said. Okay, where's the de-escalation? The person, the family, really wanted to curse him out, right? So they don't involve themselves in healthy conversations with us.
You know, and what you're saying here, this is something I've found a lot. I'm up on the phones here, but I think it's important to say, and I've said this to the commissioner, almost every commissioner who's been on the show, I've said this to, police commissioner I'm talking about, is that the police leadership will not admit that, and I'm going to say this, and I don't mean any disrespect here, that the majority of police officers on the street are deeply disrespectful to especially black community members in the way they speak to people.
That's right.
When you looked at the report from No Boundaries, which was a very powerful report because it didn't just, I mean, they talked about the physical abuse that takes place, but that wasn't, when I read that report five times, just going through it and thinking about what it was saying. And what the majority of people were saying there was the verbal abuse they feel every day. That's That to me is even a bigger issue than when one really horrible cop hitting a man in the head with a walkie-talkie and breaking his jaw. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do.
How do you get to that?
And children, witnessing that too, though.
Right. That's a great
point.
So when the brother talked about the children acting, you know, out, they see that. They see that authority is disrespectful.
So a police chief or a police commissioner is in a tough spot sometimes where they can't come out and say.
No, of course not.
Right? We all understand that. But I happen to know for certain that the police commissioners that I've known and many in leadership positions in the Baltimore Police Department right now are dedicated to de-escalation.
Okay.
I mean, they're right now looking at the entrance level training and how to incorporate it throughout the curriculum. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're actually working with them on that. So they're doing many of the right things. Now, here's the difficulty. It's a pretty big organization. It comes with a history of many years of how it does business, its subculture, if you will. Mm-hmm. That doesn't change quickly. Yeah. And it starts with leadership, but you just can't change it in a year or two. Yeah. It takes time, and it takes influx of new people and as people retire and leave. So I'm very heartened by what's going on in the police department right now. And if it's sustained and it keeps going, you know, again, it's going to take some time. But they're in the right – they know what to do. It's just a matter of how do you change that huge subculture. And one of the frustrations – and this is not particular to Baltimore, it's or any police agency. You can make the academy the best place in the world, the most contemporary, finest quality training in the world. But if that recruit graduates and goes out – and the first thing they hear is, well, forget all that stuff you learned in the academy. This is how we do it out here.
Right.
So you got to get to those sergeants and lieutenants to change that culture, right? And that's happening, but it's going to take some time. And I think we need to be patient a little bit with that, with this process of change.
Let me try to get some callers in here and come right back to our panel before we get run out of time. And I think this is we're actually, to me, in some ways, at the heart of the matter. And one of the things that we said in the air before I've been talking to people about and the mayor, the mayoral candidates, and more, which is maybe part of police training is the police need to go live in the community for a period of time before they become officers.
Or even being a part of the training. Like, that's what I was going to ask. Like, how many community members, community advocates, community people are a part of the training when in the academy? I mean, because I think it makes sense to connect those cadets to community people in the beginning.
And there are clear plans to do that as we speak, and that's the people realize that needs to be done. That's important, right?
Mm-hmm.
To build empathy, build understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, but that's not the total answer. It's a huge leap forward in the recruit training, but we've got to also address the rest of the organization, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So, let me try to get some calls in here. 410-319-8888. Michael, you're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon. Actually, good morning, guys.
Hi, Michael.
Good morning.
My thought was to the young lady who spoke on the community, you know, stepping up and playing a more paramount role in addressing our youth today. My thing is people are so traumatized and are so fearful of the way our youth react to certain situations. I mean, I'm 50 years old, and I tried to intervene in certain situations where I've seen something that was about to escalate, and I've had a gun pulled on me. Mm. With thoughts like that and with so many tragic stories that you see in the news today, it's really hard to fault the community for wanting to take a stand-back approach to this crisis, because it's just so demonic in the way that these kids respond to the smallest of situations.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not defeated, but I just feel as though, you know, you can't really fault the community for so much for not wanting to intervene when they see things in the community that are out of whack.
And I appreciate the call. Again, I think that, you know, when people make the call into the show and make comments like the one we just heard from Michael. I mean, you can't dismiss them.
No, nope.
They're not. That's real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's real. I mean, because Clayton, you're in your community every day. You intervene, but also part of it is because you and the men you work with in that house and the people around you have been living in the community for a long time. Mm-hmm. It is your community. You're one of the elders in the community. You have respect of people. Mm-hmm. So when you walk into a situation, people say, stop and listen for a minute because of who you are.
True.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you work with gangs. You don't turn them in the police. You sit and work with people.
Right.
So it's not so easy just for people like Michael or other people just to intervene because kids out here are angry. A lot of young people in the city, not the majority, but a lot of young people in the city are armed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's real. And we got to deal with that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that, so, I mean, how do you respond to Michael?
I mean, I'm think you know, I totally understand where Michael's coming from. But I'm thinking figuring out ways to get involved with young folks, even on like a micro level. Like, even if you don't have, even if you don't want to like jump out there and correct five young guys or women standing in the neighborhood, right? But on a micro level, you might be a teacher and you might live next door to a single mother who has like two children. And you can involve yourself in ways like reading to them on like a Saturday morning. So like figuring out what your skills are and, you know, figuring out ways to give those children your skills. I'm talking about like not on this huge level of like jumping out like I do. Like, I'm not expecting folks to do what I do. But what I do expect community folks to do is figure out ways on a very micro level to connect with the children, because they need our support. Like, that young guy that pulled out that gun on you, he, ironically enough, he's traumatized in some kind of way.
Traumatized with a gun, though.
He's traumatized with a gun, and that's deadly, right? But even he still needs support. Even he still needs to figure out a way to handle his anger.
Right, right, no, absolutely. Right, so. No, I think that's why we need other programs in the community besides just police who can deal with that anger and bring the kids around. Mm-hmm. Quick thoughts from you two before we get another caller on here?
Well, I'd like to speak about the gun issue. So if people are feeling unsafe and they feel like they're not safe to walk down the street or go to school, what are they doing? They're going to start carrying a gun. So you have people out there carrying a gun for what they would call their own protection. Mm-hmm. And then you have criminal elements out there carrying guns to protect their own or to retaliate against this and that. But it's basically because of feeling of lawlessness, right? We're going to have to take this into our own hands and protect our own and retaliate for what happened last week down the block. And so, mm-hmm. you know, the answer to that, I think, is right on with, you know, how do you take youth and give them a positive thing to affiliate with or mm-hmm. to identify with as a part of? Because they'll be a part of a gang or part of a, I'm so scared, I'm going to take a gun to school mm-hmm. just to, you know, just I don't want to be messed with, right? So too many people with guns, but, you know, the answer is not just go collect all the guns. The answer is make it safe.
Yeah. And Clayton, I want to get the phones here, but you that's what you do.
That's what I do.
Every day.
Every day. And relationships are real important. That's a big word in the community. If you allow yourself to be open to forming relationships, mm-hmm. even if the young man, okay, pull the gun on him, all right, hit the restart button. When you see him again, speak to him.
Yeah. Hey, man.
Say, you know, we might have had a misunderstanding. Okay, find a way to start a healing process, because he sounds like he's someone that's very interested in his community.
Yes, he does.
All right. So need to understand now, okay, that things are going to happen in this crisis that we're in. But just because something happened to you, don't be discouraged. Be more determined.
Now, I think also what you're saying is where the investment has to go. The investment has to go in somebody like Clayton Guyton to train other Clayton Guytons in the street to be in the middle of it. That's where the money has to go.
Thank you, Ma.
410-319-8888, if we're going to have any hope of ending the violence.
Yeah.
And having police actually be part of the community is another piece of this. But let's go to the phones. Very quick thought. Who do we say we're going to? James, is that right? Yeah, you're on the air, James. Welcome. We only have a couple minutes left. What's your thought? James, you there? James, are you there? Okay, James is not there. Leo, you're on the air.
Good morning, everybody.
Good
morning.
We only have about
Well, look, I heard the bus driver. I heard the criticism about the children. But there is an absence of justice in this city.
Yeah.
And the mayor's Office of Criminal Justice is in tatters because the mayor is not doing enough. I think every 2 weeks the mayor should be in North Baltimore, East Baltimore, South Baltimore, talking to grassroots organizations that are seeking solutions. I get the impression that the mayor and the city council and all these other professional politicians feel like they know the answer. Kevin Davis has refused to release the findings on Freddie Gray, the complete findings. I don't understand that, except that the Fraternal Order of Police is still telling folks what they must do. The Civilian Review Board has no subpoena powers, and you're going to close school and fire 300 people and say that that is the priority. No, the priority should be education in our city, first and foremost.
And on that note, you have the last word of the day. Leo Burrows, always good to hear from you.
Thank you, sir.
I want to thank our guests here. This has been a really interesting conversation.
Thank you, Mark.
Where it wound up, I think. Nicole Hansen is the new executive director of Out for Justice. Good to have you in the house.
Thank you.
My old friend Clayton Guyton, executive director of Rose Street. Good to have you in the house. And Doug Ward, director of the Johns Hopkins University Division of Public Safety Leadership. Always good to see you. I'm glad you joined us.
Always great to be
Appreciate
here.
Appreciate your work. Right. And folks, we're going to take a short break. When we come back from this quick news break, we'll be talking about something a little bit different. We'll be talking about African Americans. Baseball, why aren't there more black players, and what does it have to do with safety in our children? Stay with us. We'll be right back.